Ultimate Invention by Don Howarth, with Simon Callow as the Grand Duke Alexander and Alan Bennett as Francis Block. The Ultimate Invention.
This year, the 200th anniversary will be celebrated of the birth of Francis Block, an inventor of genius, whose works at one time bade to place our province, then a remote duchy in a rural empire, at the head of the world's industrial progress.
What we devise today, other nations and empires adopt tomorrow,
the Grand Duke Alexander proclaimed, when, at the zenith of their success together, Francis Block delivered the ultimate invention. Alexander, a young theological student, had succeeded his aged uncle to the duchy in the year of grace 1830, determined to haul our backward lands into the ripening 19th century.
Progress, progress, progress.
As you say, Your Grace, a bounty of which we have enjoyed too little heretofore.
My uncle, God rest his soul, was a stick-in-the-mud comptroller of the household, a country bumpkin.
God rest his soul, he loved the land.
That land on which at last he was spread-eagle for his pains by a thunderbolt in the hunting field. I shall not hunt.
No, Your Grace.
My mind is acute, so my ecclesiastic tutors believed.
Indeed.
But narrow, cloistered, entrapped within religious modes. The finances are in good heart, comptroller.
In fairly good heart, Your Grace.
Then I shall travel.
Yeah.
I shall begin forthwith at dawn.
There are matters, Your Grace. The Imperial Inspector of Taxes is expected within the month.
Hide the silver, bury the grain, drive the cattle into the forests.
Yes, Your Grace. And Mr. Block, the artisan, has waited on the doorstep since the hour of the smiting of your late uncle. He craves your permission to proceed with his invention.
Invention? Of what?
That he will not say. Your late uncle, God rest his soul.
Yes, 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 yes.
Who was indebted to Mr. Block for many conveniences, nevertheless of late, and being himself advanced in years, forbade him to proceed with the unspecified and perhaps unspeakable invention, lest it prove to be some machine or process abominable in the sight of God.
How could one know until it was seen?
One couldn't.
Then bid him proceed. Progress, progress. If what is produced should prove abominable, then we shall put him in the thumbscrews.
Very good, Your Grace. A most pragmatic solution.
Well, then, if there's nothing more to detain me...
Nothing that will not wait.
Order my carriage at dawn.
The Grand Duke travelled widely. He inspected palaces in France and factories and coal mines in England. He consorted with sages, poets, and philosophers, broadened his clerical mind in more general ways, and full of high spirits, returned after an interval of 2 years. The coffers by then were empty, and a demand had been received from the Imperial Inspector of Taxes, which could in no wise be met.
Painful, Your Grace, painful.
How shall it be raised?
Only by imposing further taxes on the peasantry. They will groan under them.
What credit does it do us to rule over groaning peasants? We must set about creating wealth, as we do in the West, by industry. We must build factories, sink coal mines, dig canals. Our peasants will groan no longer. They will sing to the tune of machines.
The noble chorus.
We shall prevail by enterprise and invention.
Then Mr. Block is your man.
Who, pray, is Mr. Block?
Mr. Block, the artisan. You granted him permission before your departure to proceed with what he terms the ultimate invention.
I vaguely remember, but first we must prime the pump.
Prime the pump, Your Grace?
We must lay hands on the stake with which we shall make the great gamble. Marriage to some princess endowed with wealth might well revive our coffers.
The most happy and traditional thought.
But before that, we must have water.
Water?
Comptroller, have you reflected on what passed through the minds of the Crusaders when they stood outside Constantinople?
Not frequently of late, Your Grace.
They came, as they believed, from seats of ultimate civilization in the West. And there before them, at the end of Europe, stood a city with walls and towers and minarets beyond their dreams.
A shock.
They beheld the wonders of water supply, drained from the hills, carried through aqueducts and conduits, piped to the very rooms of the households. Not a new invention, but a system known before Christ and followed for 1,000 years. Mm. And 1,000 years more have passed since then. Do I have such a system in my castle?
Not as yet, it must be confessed.
What woman of birth and standing in this year of grace would countenance the bucket?
The bucket.
The bucket, flung down and hauled up the well, the mud in the courtyard, the rats in the roof. I have travelled, comptroller, and I shall not consent to dwell like a country gobbin.
Renovation does appear, indeed, overdue, but there are the taxes to consider, Your Grace.
With the waterworks, we shall bag an heiress. With the dowry, we shall establish our industry. With its profits, we shall pay the taxes. And my ambition ranges further. I shall free the serfs, pave the roads, and provide you, comptroller of the household, with an office with an opening window.
Oh, Your Grace is too kind.
Then let us put the waterworks in hand.
There again, Your Grace, Mr. Block would be your man.
Summon him forthwith.
Summon Mr. Block.
Summon Mr. Block. Summon Mr. Block.
Well, what is it? Mm. Oh, His Grace has commanded a system of piped water.
Should have been installed centuries ago.
But a modern system with fountains in the courtyard, an eternal waterfall, and a pool for bathing in summertime.
Yes, yes.
We should aim to rival Versailles.
Well, I've never been there, so I don't know, but we could rig up something passable for you.
Mr. Block is given to understatement, Your Grace.
When, it's hard to say.
I require it forthwith.
I'm otherwise engaged.
What upon?
The ultimate invention.
What will that do?
Multiply the power of man by many times.
You speak in the spirit of the age.
I don't know about that.
But there are already such machines in the West, you know, Mr. Block. Engines that drive the machinery of factories. Engines like stiff men with square shoulders that pump water from coal pits. Engines installed on wheels that impart locomotion to the whole assembly. It would be virtuous on your part to reinvent such contraptions, but, alas, redundant.
I shan't reinvent anything.
I should not wish to see your manhood pass in inventing the wheel.
I shan't invent the wheel.
I admire your confidence, Mr. Block. We shall see stirring times together in the pursuit of your inventions, but how shall we finance them except by dowry, and how shall we win a dowry without a water supply? Dig the reservoir, Mr. Block, and all will flow from it.
Thank you, Mr. Block. That will be all for today.
A good man, I think, Comptroller.
An excellent man. But I do emphasize, Your Grace, that the coffers are empty. With what funds shall we meet the cost of the works?
How do the clergy pass their days?
In the cure of souls, do they not?
Would they not be more profitably employed in the tuition of the young?
Clergy as tutors?
They've turned to it in France. We will pair their stipends accordingly and tax their fees.
It's a revenue of sorts, Your Grace.
Enough to start the water flowing. Let the works commence. Night and day, Comptroller?
Apparently, Your Grace, if the water is to be brought on time.
How many men are working within the castle walls?
250, I believe, in all, on the pipes and flues and the fountain in the courtyard. 300 are digging the reservoir in the hills, and 500 at work on the aqueducts and conduits.
We must put Versailles in the shade.
Yes, Your Grace.
We must outstrip the West.
Yes. A grave matter has arisen, Your Grace.
What do you say?
A grave matter. Oh, I wish to speak quietly.
Stop the hammering, pro tem.
Stop the hammering, pro tem.
Stop the hammering, pro tem.
Close the door. You will recall, Your Grace, your inventive decision to raise revenue by hiring out the clergy as tutors to the children of richer peasants.
Happily received, I believe, by clergy and laity alike.
Indeed, and happy in its resolution in our civilized immediate vicinity, but at one or two places in the more remote and bucolic districts, the intention, it seems, has been misconstrued.
In what fashion?
The purpose has been misunderstood, with the consequence that the more ignorant peasants, not understanding the restricted purpose for which the clergy were hired, have had them in the shafts. One bearded old fellow drove to market tickling up with the whip the clergyman who hauled his dog cart. He is said to have shouted, "Come along, good reverend sir, show these mules and donkeys a clean pair of heels." The question being, Your Grace, whether the practice does not subvert your educational purpose. We shall surely not overtake the West by harnessing the clergy to the cart or the plough.
That's true. Stretch these fellows on the rack.
Very good, Your Grace.
Or, on second thoughts, that will do no good for our coffers, fine them half the year's harvest. Anything else?
Not at the moment, Your Grace.
Then proceed with the work. Bring forth the waters!
The water flowing down from the reservoir above the pine trees, gushed forth from taps installed in 100 rooms of the castle, filled the new ornamental lake, and rose like a silver plume in the great fountain in the courtyard.
Congratulations, Mr. Block. It does indeed rival Versailles.
It would have been better, given proper time for the job.
Not at all. You have a nasty streak of perfectionism, Mr. Block. Tinker, tinker, tinker. Controller, we are in good case now to pursue our suit with a lady.
In excellent case, Your Grace.
Well, let us see the list of candidates. We must compose billets doux and circulate them forthwith.
In the event, the amorous letters were never dispatched. The system within the castle had been hastily installed under the Duke's urgent demands, and, as Mr. Block tried to warn him, inadequately protected. A sharp frost burst the upper pipes. The castle filled up like a huge bottle, and in the intense cold of the night the water froze. From outside, the great house resembled a lavishly iced cake. Inside his chamber, the Duke lay frozen to his bed, unable to move any part except his eyes, which smouldered at those who peered in on him through the iced windows. Mr. Block was sent for, and under his direction, faggots were brought and burned in the room beneath the bedchamber, inflicting sore pain on the good Duke as his frozen limbs thawed out.
Disperse, you rabble! Back to your hovels!
Mr. Block, we have summoned you at the very dardier of our fortunes.
Yes, indeed, the tax remains to be paid. The frost and ice have split the castle walls in such a fashion that a fortune will be required to restore them.
Thus we can no longer proceed with our ambitions, step by step, because the rugs have fallen from the ladder.
Hard luck.
We must take one daring leap, one great gamble, the work you have been so long engaged on.
The ultimate invention.
Yes, you must deliver it forthwith.
It won't be ready forthwith.
And we must raise funds by selling the design in London or Paris.
It's not saleable yet, and it's not for sale.
Then we must turn many hands upon it.
It won't yield to many hands.
Who works upon it?
My apprentice and I.
Where?
Up in the hills.
He covers his tracks, Your Grace. Nobody knows where he goes. It's said that ferocious dogs guard his workplace.
When will it be ready?
It can't be rushed. Look what happened with rushing the water. Do you want things early, or do you want them right?
You're over 40 now. You might not live to see your invention perfected at this rate.
That's possible. My apprentice will carry it on.
It might by then have been discovered in the West.
No danger. It's centuries ahead of any machine in the world.
What good is that when the duchy is close to bankruptcy now?
Well, you can't have it. But, seeing you're desperate, I have a lesser thing developed as a sideline that might keep you in funds while you're waiting.
Another machine?
A balloon.
For the ascent of the atmosphere?
Yes.
My dear Mr. Block, you have done what I warned you against. You have invented the wheel. Balloons abound above Paris on a Sunday. It is a sport which even the bourgeoisie pursues.
At the mercy of the wind.
Are all balloons not at the mercy of the wind?
Not mine. It's a dirigible balloon.
Dirigible?
It can be steered. It's not entirely at the mercy of the wind.
One might use it for traversing the landscape?
Well, that's what it's for.
And it's ready now?
There are imperfections still to be remedied.
Yes, yes, yes. Can one take passage in it, or can one not?
One can.
Ah!
After a fashion.
And then I shall look forward to navigating in your balloon on Friday morning.
The balloon rose from the castle grounds at 8:15. The Grand Duke Alexander and Mr. Block acknowledging from the basket the cheers of the assembled populace. Hooray! The morning being tranquil, the aerial conveyance rose vertically into the cloudless sky until it became small as a tennis ball in our sight. Whereupon Mr. Block, by now tiny, was observed to play upon an apparatus consisting of a flange and propellers with which he had fitted his contraption, and the balloon altered course across the sky, like a ship when the sails are changed.
Now, this rudder, your rectitude, is what imparts direction. Do you follow?
No.
Good. I tug it round, and the wind then sets these propellers twirling. Clear?
No.
That's it. And they drive the balloon forward along the direction of their shaft or longitudinal axis. Follow?
No.
That is, they would drive it in such a direction if it were not for the wind that's already carrying it along the lines of its own blowing. Do you understand?
No.
Good. So we have a triangle of forces. On a tranquil day like this, when the wind is low, dirigibility is high. On a windier day, less. In a gale, it might be slight or even non-existent.
It can fail.
Ships at sea can be becalmed or make no headway. So, now you've mastered the principles and understood the limitations, where do you want to go?
I'll inspect the waterworks.
The waterworks were now in the second phase and being extended to the town and to great country houses in the vicinity. Our aeronauts followed the line of the Condit into the foothills and, rising above the slopes of pine, passed across the reservoir which men with picks and shovels were extending. At times, the balloon hung high above the workers. At times it bobbled so close that individuals could be clearly espied, and the Grand Duke upbraided from the carriage those toilers who, unaware of his silent approach, leant upon the shovel.
Dig, fellow, dig! I've got your number! I'll have you on the rack!
They passed over high forest where brown bears watched them, across the spur of desert where camel trains bolted at their shadow, past wellheads and roadside calvaries, over villages of mud and villages of stone. Everywhere, as he passed above, the good Duke chastised indolence. Peasants he upbraided in large numbers as they awoke from sleep in ditches or beneath haystacks. He spotted a pair, scarcely more than boy and girl, climb furtively from a kitchen window to make their way hand in hand for the secrecy of the bushes. His voice from the heavens convulsed them with terror.
Yes, you may well be startled. Back to the spit and the greasy pots, you scullions!
In one village, a knot of penitents waited at the locked door of the church.
Where is the parson? Still abed?
No, on the road there, beyond the wood. See, in the shafts of the cart.
Pass over him.
Faster.
Faster. Chase him with our shadow. Heels up, sir. Canter. Let's see you gallop, reverend sir. Faster. Faster.
The Grand Duke Alexander returned home in high spirits. The moment they had bumped down and been tethered on the jousting ground, he was over the side of the basket, demanding that factories be erected forthwith for the manufacture of dirigible balloons.
Thanks to the genius of our Mr. Block, we have today flown into the very van of inventive progress. Hooray! We now have the power to overleap the west in the most literal way. We can pass across the clouds above their very heads.
Hooray! Quite so, Your Grace, but...
We lead the world in the art of navigating the atmosphere. We shall fill the skies with our dirigible balloons.
Undoubtedly, Your Grace, if however we could have a private word...
Yet, what is it? Speak out, Comptroller.
Indoors, Your Grace, beyond the hearing of the throng.
Oh, very well. That's all for now. Get back to work, you loafers.
Well, what is it, Comptroller?
Your Grace, I quail to report that even as you soared above the treetops, a letter arrived from the Imperial Inspector of Taxes demanding payment and most threatening in tone. I fear it might go ill with us if we were discovered erecting balloon factories while the taxes remain unpaid.
Would they find out? We're so remote, they hardly know we exist.
It might be apparent, Your Grace, when the skies are filled with balloons. His Imperial Majesty does not take kindly to default in taxes. Was it not your own uncle, the Count Boris, whom he banished to the frozen north for hazarding the tax money on the tables of Baden-Baden?
Oh, I can't stand snow and ice, the more especially since Block throws me in my bed. What is to be done?
We could pray, perhaps.
What good would that do, you blockhead?
The Grand Duke did, however, on second thoughts, ordain a day of prayer throughout the duchy for the restoration of our fortunes, and in particular, for heavenly guidance in so developing the products of Mr. Block's genius as to put us ahead of the world. The Duke was moved himself to address this theme in prayer with the fervour he had cultivated as a theological student, and he was blessed in return by the inspired thought not to manufacture the dirigible balloon ourselves, but generously to offer it to the Emperor in lieu of tax. He dictated a letter forthwith.
The balloon is quite safe and may be used for the entertainment of ladies and gentlemen alike. or more soberly for the transport of those who wish to move expeditiously between their estates and your Majesty's court without suffering the shaking up and the danger of encountering highwaymen that bedevil travel on the roads.
Oh, a telling point, your Grace.
Moreover, turning to more weighty purposes, the balloon might be used to detect disloyal subjects and malefactors. Your revered secret police might hover and snoop silently upon plotters. Firearms could be brought to bear upon them from the basket, provided that care was taken not to puncture the fabric of the balloon with shot. In warfare, the enemy's most secret dispositions could be instantly spotted from the atmosphere. Commanders could be lassoed and winched aloft from the back of their mounts, and noxious objects could be rained from above on the rabblement of the ranks.
Oh, His Majesty would delight in that.
Yeah, now, for the final paragraph. It had been my hope that, commencing with the dirigible balloon, I should establish industrial manufacture in my duchy. In our present extremity, that hope must now be deferred. But it will give me loyal and patriotic satisfaction to see royal balloon factories established in the capital. And I venture to believe history will recall your Majesty's name in connection with the balloon as readily as Caesar is remembered for the conquest of Gaul.
Excellent, your Grace. His Majesty cannot refuse.
His Majesty did not refuse, nor did he assent. He sent down the inspector of taxes to view the balloon and to take flight in it. The morning of the proposed demonstration was wild and windy, but the inspector could in no wise be pressed to stay for an extra day, and the Duke insisted on proceeding with the flight despite Mr. Block's warnings.
This wind will have no control.
A gentle breeze, no more.
We'll be blown to kingdom come.
You'll manage, Mr. Block, you'll manage. Now, Your Excellency, if you would be good enough to step up into the basket. That's it, Your Excellency. Topple aboard. Ready to cast off, Mr. Block?
I'm not going without you.
Very well. I have the confidence in your contrivance. You seem to lack yourself. Give me a hand, please, into the basket.
Very good, sir.
That's it. Cower in the corner, Your Excellency. The breeze will become lighter in the upper atmosphere.
Your rectitude, the wind doesn't...
What do you say?
The wind doesn't become lighter in the upper atmosphere. It becomes stronger.
No. More balmy.
Less balmy. More ferocious. Here at the surface, the wind speed is reduced by the friction of the earth.
Friction of the earth? His Excellency hasn't made his long and painful journey here to listen to a scientific dissertation, have you, Your Excellency? This is not the time nor the place, Mr. Block. Pray cast off, forthwith.
Bye! If I don't come back, look after my dog.
Cast off the ropes!
Cast off the ropes! Cast off the ropes!
Instead of gracefully ascending the atmosphere as in former flights, the balloon was caught in the teeth of the wind and hurtled horizontally across the jousting ground. It tore through the branches of trees. It bumped against the rises in the ground and bounded up again, sweeping off chimneys. It carried the flagpole from the church tower. It made the dogs of the town wild with fear. It frightened the bullocks to thunder round their fields. And at last, caught in a powerful gust from another direction, it hurtled across the horizon and out of sight beyond the forest. Of the three men in the basket, all that was seen from the moment of casting off was their pallid faces peering above the rim. Onlookers with keen sight said their eyes were closed in prayer. Spring had arrived before our two aeronauts returned, ragged and bearded, so much like vagrants in their broken boots that the first intimation of their arrival was the noise of the dogs setting upon them.
Oh, no, get down, you beast! Get off! Get on!
Show off your dogs, you rabble! I'm the Grand Duke Alexander, returned to chastise you!
It transpired that before eventually dumping them back on the surface of the earth, the gale had carried them across rivers and mountain ranges and deserts to a land so distant that they could hardly understand the language. The peasants there lurked long behind the hedges before venturing out to see what they might salvage from the riven fabric and the shattered basket. They left our aeronauts comatose from the impact, lying among such of the wreckage as they did not care to haul away.
Brutal devils they were, Comptroller. Ah. Yeah, but we came upon worse, did we not, Mr. Block?
We did, your rectitude.
Chaps with wispy beards wearing smocks. May God be praised, they'd greet us. Forever and ever, we'd reply in unison. We bow to God's will, they'd follow up.
In his hands is our peace,
we'd reply. All this, you understand, in language we scarcely understood.
Of course, your grace.
Carry a while, dear strangers, they said. Break bread with us. And when we demurred...
They said, thanks, but we've still 500 miles to walk.
They pressed their hospitality upon us. A guest in the house, they said.
It's like God in the house.
By my oath, as we slept with the cow and the donkey, they came crawling through and would have murdered us for our clothes.
They would have murdered us. Yes,
had it not been for a jingling contraption Mr. Block devised behind the door as an alarm.
Oh, most ingenious.
I owe my survival entirely to him. He found food in the tundra and water in the desert. He repaired our boots with bark, fashioned rafts to cross rivers, and devised snares and traps to catch wild animals to feed us.
When our
fortunes turn the corner, Comptroller, I shall erect a statue to Mr. Block in the town square.
Well, that's very nice.
Indeed. Your Grace, we have received, as you may surmise, a series of inquiries from the court regarding the disappearance of the Inspector of Taxes. I have prevaricated, not wishing merely to say he had gone with the wind.
Of course not. He left us. He insisted on striking straight for the capital. We heard the wolves howl as he disappeared into a forest. But if they didn't have him, the bears might. And, of course, once he had crossed the frontier into our own country, there are all too many of our fellow nobles, bandits by nature, who would make short work of a lost and defenceless tax inspector. He was not the most popular man in the empire.
But highly valued by the emperor. I fear that however he met his end, the emperor holds us responsible. Ours was the last territory within the empire on which his feet touched the ground.
Are you broaching some disagreeable matter?
Yes, I fear I am, Your Grace. His Majesty's secretary has conveyed to me that if the inspector should eventually return safely, our tax will be doubled as a penalty for having incommoded the court.
Preposterous!
But if he should fail to return, it will be set at 10,000 pieces in perpetuity.
Ah. Ah. There's only one thing for it, Mr. Block, and this time I do insist. We must have the ultimate invention from you.
Shortly.
Tomorrow.
It's not ready.
It will never be ready.
It's not perfected.
It will never be perfected. Perfection is not to be found on this earth. Does the machine work or doesn't it?
It works.
Good.
After a fashion.
Very well, then. I will see it work after a fashion at dawn.
But
Mr. Block, please don't demur. The choice is fame and fortune on the one hand, or the rack and the thumbscrews on the other. Be ready at dawn, please.
But Mr. Block was not ready at dawn, or at any time during the day, or the week, or the month. When he returned to his secret workshop in the hills, he discovered that his apprentice, Joseph, the only other living being who had set eyes on the ultimate machine, had gone.
Gone?
Gone?
Gone.
Gone where?
He fell in with some gypsy woman in my regrettable and unnecessary absence.
Yes, 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 yes.
And went off to other lands with the caravan.
Did he take the ultimate invention with him?
A lad in love doesn't stop to haul off ironmongery.
But will he not carry the design in his head?
He will. But the gypsies won't tarry to manufacture it.
Others might. He could sell the design to some ironworks.
He doesn't know it completely. There are secret parts I kept to myself and buried before I left. They haven't been disturbed.
Good. But this is all the more reason why we must have the machine at once. Inventors in the West do not wait for perfection. They're down to the patent office and the forge the moment a machine creaks into life.
What good is that if it stops again?
To be the first is what matters. The rest, the perfectionists, come second and disappear into the limbo. There are no prizes for inventing the wheel. I will stretch a point. I will not insist upon this week or this month, but I categorically require delivery of the invention at whatever state it has reached on Midsummer Day.
Block retired to his workshop in the hills, whence the roar of the forge, the clang of the anvil and the tapping of the hammer were heard through the long days of that glorious spring. while the Duke Alexander, now optimistically anticipating the profit that would ensue, studied the form and breeding of ladies whose hand he might seek, and whose dowries might impart a faster spin to the wheel of our hopefully improving fortune.
We've gone down and down, Comptroller. We touched bottom in the wreckage of the balloon. Now we can only go up and up, like the waters in yon gracious fountain.
Indeed, Your Grace. All seems possible in springtime.
Good morning, Your Grace.
What's that noise?
Midsummer's Day, Your Grace. The ultimate invention is arriving at the jousting ground.
Oh, let's see it. That, I take it, is the first installment.
They said they are ready, Your Grace.
Is that what we've waited for all these years? That little heap of iron?
I do not know, Your Grace, but Mr. Block has sent word that he is ready for inspection.
The Duke tucked his nightshirt into his trousers and bounced down the stairs and out to the jousting ground, where a crowd of servants of the castle and citizens of the town had assembled.
Is this the machine, Mr. Block?
It is, Your Rectitude.
Is what we see here just the central principle? Are there other members still to come?
This is the machine. Imperfect in many details.
Yes. But here it stands entire, does it?
Yes.
This is the machine with which we shall overleap the industrial power of France and England.
That's it.
Quiet, you rabble. Stand back.
To where would steam power be connected?
It needs no steam.
Where should it be installed?
It needs no installation.
What does it manufacture?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. It's not a manufacturing machine. It's one for locomotion.
Locomotion?
It's a conveyance.
Using what power?
Manpower.
It has but two wheels. How shall it remain upright?
The locomotion ensures that the wheels remain upright.
How can that be?
Well, the force of gravity is overcome by the generation of forces at the rim of the wheels.
Mr. Block, now, this isn't the time or place for a scientific dissertation. Your contraption, I very much fear, is something less than the ultimate invention. It is, in fact, a mere toy.
Did you see such toys in your travels in the West?
No.
Nor anything resembling it?
No, but so simple a thing must have been thought of.
Your favourite invention, to which you're always alluding, the wheel, that was the most simple of all things. But how long did it take mankind to discover it?
Centuries, I grant you.
Scores of centuries. 1,000 ages. And it's taken as long to invent my machine. It could have been invented any time after the Iron Age, but where in history or where in the present world might such a machine be found? Nowhere. Except here, outside your castle walls today.
But there's nothing to it. Two wheels and ironwork supporting a saddle between them.
The like of it has never been seen before, and it will not be superseded till the end of time.
Oh, come.
It will be improved upon. If it was left to me, I'd scrap this particular machine and start again.
No, please. It's taken long enough already.
Right, then. It'll be improved upon, but never superseded. On this primitive model, which is fit really only for a museum, a man could travel 60 or 80 miles a day at 4 times the speed he could walk.
4 times the speed?
And because of its simplicity, which you seem to have taken against,
it
could be manufactured in quantity at any ironworks.
I see that.
And at a cost to place it within the reach of the common man.
Quiet, you dogs! Keep your distance!
It will put the populace awheel. Men will no longer tarry, but rather swirl about the surface of the earth.
Would that be good for the soul?
It would be good for your revenues.
Well, then there's nothing more to be said. Mr. Block, pray demonstrate the ultimate invention.
Stand back, you rabble! Stand back!
I sit astride in the saddle, so I compose myself and lay hold of the steering bar. Now I'm going to raise 1 foot to the treadles, and then when I'm in motion, I'll raise the other. The rotation of my feet imparts rotation to the wheels, which puts the machine in locomotion and maintains it upright.
It works! It works! History is being made this midsummer morn. Our rustic province leads the world!
The Grand Duke insisted on mastering control of the machine himself, which he accomplished in 3 days, though sorely bruised from many spills. He then set about speed trials, sending for servants the most fleet of foot to engage in races with him round the jousting ground, and eventually pitting himself with creditable result against a carriage and pair. All that accomplished within a week, he convoked the Assembly of the Duchy, a body constituted by an eccentric antecedent with leanings towards democracy, not previously convened for 120 years.
My lords, reverend gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, no doubt as you have passed the jousting ground of late, you will have observed my person in the act of gaining mastery over the ultimate machine. You will have observed me in happy times a wheel, and in less happy times a ground. This machine, ladies and gentlemen, will put us in the very van of progress. We will go on to establish factories and coal mines far surpassing those of the West. We shall build thriving towns, soaring cathedrals, and a great city. Regrettably, however, ladies and gentlemen, in our penurious and indebted state, lacking any metal industry beyond a few blacksmith's shops, we are in no case ourselves to manufacture the machine in such quantities as might flood the markets of the world before the West wakes up and begins to manufacture in competition. We must not tinker. Rather, we must boldly choose to have the machine wrought not in little workshops, but in the mightiest ironworks of the empire, the cannon factory in the capital. I have decided that I shall go there myself and call upon the director in person and in the company of Mr. Block here.
Hello.
What is more, we shall not go by carriage and have the ultimate machine delivered by cart. Oh, no, we shall ride the machine there, the whole 1,000 miles. We shall treadle to the very threshold of the works. There remains only the question of the naming of the machine. Its name, I believe, should reflect its peculiarity, that it has but 2 wheels revolving in a single track. I therefore think it fitting to call this ultimate machine the bicycle. 2 wheels. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And if you will forgive a small personal vanity, since I have sponsored the development of the machine, stood by it through thick and thin, encouraged failing hearts, and in the end demanded delivery from its 2 perfectionist inventor, Mr. Buckley, I should like, with your consent and approval, and in all modesty, to link the machine in perpetuity to my own name. I propose, therefore, the Alexander Bicycle.
The Grand Duke and Mr. Block departed shortly after dawn, outpacing those of the common people who attempted to run alongside through the streets. They passed through the gate and eventually disappeared down the dusty road in the mist of the summer morning. They rode both on the one machine, being that too grievous an amount of time would have been expended in manufacturing a second. The one treadled, and the other rode on a step which Mr. Block had secured besides the rear hub, taking turn about as the journey went on, though with Mr. Block the more frequently at the office of treadling. Peasants came to the hedges to see, and persons of quality to the walls of their houses. Church bells were rung as our mechanics approached the outlying villages, and the populace assembled along the street to give cheering passage. At evenings in the grounds of noble houses, young ladies demurely observed the arrival of the Grand Duke, who took care always to be himself at the treadles when an estate was approached.
We're turning their heads, Mr. Block. It bodes well for our prospects, both of sales and of matrimony.
At more than one place, rich nobles attempted to buy the machine on the spot.
Not for the fortune of an Arabian prince, my dear sir. I shall have a machine struck and embossed with your escutcheon when manufacture commences. Meanwhile, you must bide patiently.
One disappointed nobleman had his minions attempt to steal the machine in the night.
A close call, Mr. Block. You must henceforth eschew the comfort of a bed and compose yourself to sleep with the machine. Chain your ankle to the frame, if you would be so kind.
Oh.
The sun shone every day, and the first part of the journey passed at speed and in harmony. Mr. Block rejoicing at exchanging the habitual dark of his workshop for the open air. The spills they suffered, occasioned by the unexpected turning of a peasant cart, or by ruts the long past winter had left in the dusty road, these spills caused no broken bones, and came to be accepted with some bravado by our travellers, as part of the exciting hazards of bicycling. As they sped along in high spirits, the riders began to look forward to further inventions that would enhance the fame and fortune of our duchy, after the ultimate machine had been presented to the world.
A flying machine. That's what I have in mind.
Not another dirigible balloon.
No, a machine that will carry its own power. A machine with a steam engine on board.
Flying through the air with a steam engine.
Or a machine for speaking, holding colloquy over long distances.
It would have to amplify the voice to a bellow.
No, it would convey a whisper from a voice, say, in the duchy to an ear in the capital.
A whisper across 1,000 miles?
Yes. And then have an idea for a machine for slicing hams.
A machine for slicing hams.
With a wheel to be turned by hand and a reciprocating platform. Oh, laugh if you wish. You couldn't have strained your imagination a year ago to envisage this machine we're riding on now.
True, true. Yes. Treadle harder, please, Mr. Block. We're losing ground against that horseman opposite.
A dust cloud had been keeping pace with them on a road parallel to theirs, but 3 or 4 miles away across the dusty plain. They would lose sight of it behind a forest, or a rise in the land, or an elevated village. Then it would appear again, moving at their speed. It was travelling too fast for a horse-drawn vehicle, and so far as it was possible to judge over so great a distance, it was raising a lesser cloud of dust. A single horseman seemed to have taken them on in a race. He kept pace through the day, stopping when they stopped for food, and returning to his own saddle when they resumed treadling.
Is he a messenger, meaning to meet us where the roads converge?
He might be.
Bearing what tidings?
God knows.
Is there a plot to waylay us?
Oh, I shouldn't have thought so.
Is he spying on the machine?
Not at that distance.
Treadle harder, Mr. Block. Leave him behind.
I can't. He's faster than us. How about you taking a turn at the treadles?
They changed about. They did not stop to eat. Whenever they fell off, they immediately resumed their journey, pausing to attend neither to their hurts nor to the damage to the machine. But they made no impression on the mysterious dust cloud. In the late afternoon, a shower of rain cleared the haze, and when it had passed, revealed beneath the rainbow the rider across the plain.
He is not a horseman, Mr. Block.
No.
He is riding a bicycle. Who is he?
I don't know.
Where did he get the notion? Where was his machine fashioned? He knows our plans. I do believe he means to race us to the cannon works.
Our travellers, baffled and shaken, nevertheless had the wisdom to waste no more time in speculation. Rather, they adopted a practical stratagem to outpace the rival to the winning post. As dusk fell, they entered the gate of a village in full view of the distant road, as though to rest for the night. But when darkness came, weary and perplexed though they were, they trundled out the machine and resumed their journey under the stars, meaning to set a lead of many leagues. From the moment that dawn began to spread across the earth, they travelled with twisting necks, peering through the mist towards the road on the horizon. The mist cleared. They saw the rival treadling along parallel.
Stop, Mr. Block. Let's take stock. He reads our minds. It's somebody we know.
Who?
There's some different principle to his machine. It moves without treadling.
He is treadling.
Look, now he's stopped. The machine is still moving. Is that possible?
Yes, it is possible. It's a refinement you refuse me time to develop.
And rightly, even now we've tarried too long.
It's what I'd call a free wheel.
But who else would know about that?
There is one person.
Who?
My apprentice, Joseph, who went off with the gypsies. That's him there.
Scandalous!
He's found a sponsor whenever he's settled.
Oh, but we are the inventors. Thousands of people in our own duchy and in the other provinces through which we have passed have witnessed our machine.
His machine has been seen too. But country folks' viewing counts for nothing. The first to the capital will be hailed as the inventor. The second will be pelted as an impostor.
Scandalous!
We must race him to the bridge where the roads converge and stop him. Beyond there, we're in the hills, and the two of us mounted would never catch a single rider.
Our travellers treadled on through the heat of the day and the chill of the night, through storms of hail and high winds that raised the dust of the fields like midday darkness. They stopped for only 2 hours' sleep at night and dozed during their turn as passenger, standing with sagging knees on the step besides the back wheel. Their rival, being alone, was obliged to stop for longer, and twice at dawn he had been outpaced, out of sight. But each day, as the older men wilted in the heat of the sun, he drew abreast and even pulled ahead, taunting their weary legs by sailing along for stretches without treadling.
He's made a sound job of that free wheel. But it looks from here a cruder machine in general than ours. Bears every sign of being bodged up in a hurry.
By now, the converging roads were only a mile apart, and the approach to the bridge, where they could meet, only 5 miles ahead. Neither machine slackened pace. The knees of the treadlers pumped like pistons. The wheel bearings glowed red hot. Joseph was no longer taking rests by using his free wheel. The Grand Duke and Mr. Block, when the time came to exchange positions, did so precariously without halting the onward rush of the machine. The bridge came in sight. The roads converged. Both machines swerved at the same moment onto the planking of the narrow bridge. They raced shoulder to shoulder and wheel to wheel along the decking. Then, locking together at high speed, they slewed over the low parapet and tumbled down into the river.
My lords, reverend gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen of the Duchy Assembly, I have sensed abroad in these latter days a mood of pessimism incurred by the loss of the ultimate invention, the Alexander bicycle, in the muddy waters of the Nada River. Can it not be salvaged? I hear you demand. Alas, it cannot. The riverbed is composed of soft sand. The machine is engulfed and lost to the end of time, together with the inferior second model manufactured by the escaped apprentice Joseph under the patronage of our cousin and rival, the Duke Ferdinand. The apprentice Joseph, arrested by our good uncle, the Marquis Basil, and delivered back here in a sack, has been clapped in irons. And any secrets he attempts to withhold concerning his developments to the ultimate machine will be drawn from him on the rack. Now, having dealt with our misfortunes, I have an announcement to make which can only give you the greatest happiness. In 2 years' time, in celebration of the 25th anniversary of his reign, it is the expressed pleasure of His Imperial Majesty to visit the more remote and bucolic parts of his empire. You will be delighted to learn that our humble duchy is to be included in his itinerary. I have commanded Mr. Block to commence the fashioning of a new bicycle, but I shall not now, on mature consideration, transport it for manufacture to the cannon works. I shall instead present it as a gift to the Emperor in person. Thus, I trust to bridge the slight rift between our duchy and the crown caused by the non-payment of taxes and the regrettable loss of the imperial tax inspector. I further dare to hope that out of his well-known magnanimity, viewing the magnificent machine we shall offer him, he may graciously exorcise and expunge our debt. And while he is enraptured by the gift, I may be emboldened with your support to seek the hand of his daughter, the Princess Anna, which, being granted, would solve all problems that beset us and enable us here to build the coal-mine-ridden, smoke-belching, canal-traversed industrial duchy of our dreams. I shall propose many gentlemen for ennoblement.
I shall give my comptroller an office with an opening window. I shall erect a statue to our excellent Mr. Block. I shall call a holiday. And I shall free the serfs. We must gamble everything on this coup. The cannon will be fired to greet the Emperor's arrival. Elephants, tumblers, racehorses, and minstrels will be brought in. We shall have a banquet of Oriental splendor. At the end of the day, under torchlight, I shall present to His Imperial Majesty the Alexander bicycle, decorated with brass, equipped with a saddle, tooled by our finest leather workers, and fitted with the ultimate device of the ultimate machine, the free wheel.
The next 2 years were a period of strenuous enterprise in our duchy. To placate the court, a gesture was made towards paying off the tax debt, by borrowing money from lenders at usurious rates, and by levying new internal taxes on windows, wheels, and rosary beads. Every economy was made in order to afford the extravagance of the visit on which all our hopes depended. Mr. Block, for his part, worked long hours on the royal bicycle, assisted by his forgiven apprentice Joseph, both of them labouring to eliminate the imperfections which troubled the good Block in time for the imperial visit. A long wait for those in anguish at the gamble, too brief a time for our perfectionist mechanics. The day of the royal visit, June the 3rd, dawned bright and crisp, and the Grand Duke was early abroad to inspect the preparations, lingering over the ultimate machine built for the Emperor and delivered to the castle late the previous night.
Magnificent, Block. Magnificent.
It'll pass.
After breakfast, the Duke and Mr. Block ascended the tower together with the comptroller of the household to watch out through binoculars and telescope for the arrival of the Emperor's retinue and to signal the firing of cannon by way of salute.
There now! There! On the horizon!
Yes! Yes! What a train of persons!
Oh, he must have brought the whole court.
Why so lugubrious, Comptroller?
Well, the cost will ruin us completely if he refuses the bait.
He won't refuse. He's smart enough to know a work of genius when he sees it. Where are they now, Mr. Block?
Stop behind the big wood on the horizon. Smoke coming up over the trees.
They'll be cooking the royal breakfast. I believe His Majesty enjoys breakfast at the roadside.
At the roadside?
Oh, yes, he's a very homely chap. Afterwards, I'm told, he and his immediate entourage get down for exercise and ride on horseback a mile or two in advance of the retinue.
Do they indeed?
We might, perhaps, broach the other inventions with him. What do you think, Block?
Why not? If the bicycle puts him in the right mood.
It must, it must.
What other inventions, Your Grace?
Things Block has in mind.
A flying machine.
Good heavens.
A machine for speaking over long distances.
I say.
And another for slicing ham.
Good gracious.
And there's one I haven't mentioned.
What's that?
A vessel that would sail submerged and fire balls through the hulls of enemy fleets.
Splendid, splendid. That would give him command of the oceans. I'll wangle you in to sit beside him in the course of the evening, Block. Let him hear from the horse's mouth.
Protocol, Your Grace.
Oh, the Emperor won't be in a mood to stickle. You know not to eat off your knife or spit on the floor, don't you, Block? You wouldn't be overawed.
It's not me that'd be overawed.
Of course not. Just take care not to baffle the poor man. Just drop him the odd technical phrase he might subsequently enjoy throwing about in conversation.
The riders seem to be emerging now from behind the wood.
So they do. Your telescope's better than my binoculars, Comptroller. Is the Crown Prince there?
Yes.
And the Princess Anna?
Yes.
Why so glum, Comptroller?
They are all there and many more.
Good, then.
But they are not riding horses.
They're not riding.
Yes, Your Grace.
Let me look through the telescope. Oh. Oh.
Many bicycles and of many different types. They must have been in production for several years.
Oh, dear. Game is up. The bolt is shot. I'll be banished to the frozen north.
Oh, dear.
That's put paid to your office with an opening window, Comptroller.
to your statue in the square, Mr. Plogger.
I never expected it to come up.
Yes, your Grace, they are approaching. What is to be done?
Is the bicycle oiled and fit to speed away, Mr. Block?
Aye.
Then alter the saddle and flee the Empire.
But, sir, what am I to say when you've gone?
Speak in the voice of thunder. Command the cannon to fire in salute.
Thunder?
Go on, then.
Fire!
Fire, he said.
Fire!
Farewell, good people. Goodbye. Well, Mr. Block, we have done it after all, just as I warned you. We have labored all these years, and we have invented the wheel.
Seems so.
Great fun, though. Step aside, please. Let me get away down the stairs. Goodbye!
In The Ultimate Invention by Don Howarth, Simon Callow was the Grand Duke Alexander and Alan Bennett, Francis Block. Timothy Bateson was the Comptroller of the Household, Stephen Thorne the Scribe, and Simon Cuff the Footman. Peasants and other parts were played by Dominic Rickards, Nicholas Courtney, David Googe, Zila Clark, Joe Kendall, Melinda Walker, and Richard Pierce. The music was specially composed by Bernard Graham Shaw. Technical presentation was by Dave Johnston, and the production assistant was Joe Hill. The Ultimate Invention was directed by Gordon House.